Richard Stallman campaigned to change the name Linux to GNU Linux, using the logic that Linus had relied on the GNU GCC compiler and other free software tools and applications to get Linux off the ground. Others were growing increasingly irritated by the fact that Linux was finding a home in the corporate realm. The press was playing up the dichotomy between the idealists and the pragmatists, not Linus's terms, among Linux's now hundreds of thousands of participants. Under that division, those who feared that Linux's ideals were incompatible with the goals of capitalism were dubbed the idealists. Linus led the pragmatists, but he saw such analysis as journalistic nonsense, a simplistic attempt to fit everything neatly into a world of black versus white. He has the same problem with the way folks view the Linux phenomenon as a Linux versus Microsoft war, when in fact it's something else entirely, something far more wide-reaching. It's a more organic way of spreading technology, knowledge, wealth, and having fun than the world of commerce has ever known. To Linus, it was a non-issue. Without commercial interests, how else would Linux flow into new markets? How else would it create opportunities for innovations? How else would it be able to reach the people who want an alternative, a free alternative, to the bad technology that's out there? What more realistic way for open source to take hold than through the sponsorship of corporations? And what better way of getting some of the less interesting work accomplished, boring stuff like maintenance and support, than doing it inside companies? Open source is about letting everybody play. Why should business, which fuels so much of society's technological advancement, be excluded, provided that they play by the rules? Open source can do nothing but improve the technology that companies create, and maybe make them less greedy. And even if the Linux community wanted to stop the forces of commercialism, what could it do? Linus was not willing to suggest they hide, go underground, refuse to talk to commercial people. Anti-commercial sentiments have always been a part of the open source community, but it wasn't until Linux became a household word among low-tech households that there was a lot at stake. The news groups were aflame with the paranoid rantings of some of the vocal crazies. None of the Linux developers Linus interacted with were worried at all. But others raged on about how Red Hat or some other company would pervert the notions of open source, and about how some people were losing their idealism. In order to hold a very strong opinion, you have to exclude all other opinions. And that means you have to become unreasonable. So Linus was stuck with a conciliatory approach. The only time he was ever nervous about commercialism was very early on, when Linux didn't have much of a name. At that point, if commercial people had co-opted Linux, there would have been nothing he could do, but that's obviously not the case now. One concern raised in newsgroup flames amid the activity of 1998 was that commercial people wouldn't give anything back. To some extent, Linus had to trust the new corporate players as much as Linux developers were trusting him. And they proved themselves to be trustworthy. They haven't held back. So far, it's been very positive. As poster boy, holder of the Linux trademark, maintainer of the Linux kernel, Linus felt a growing sense of responsibility. He felt increasingly responsible for the fact that millions of people now relied on Linux, and immense pressure to make sure it worked as reliably as possible. It was important to him to help corporations understand what open source was all about. There was no war, as far as Linus was concerned, between the greedy corporations and the altruistic hackers. No, he wasn't giving up his ideals by meeting with Intel when they asked him to help them deal with the Pentium FOOF lockup bug. Pentium FOOF bug, I hear you ask? Yeah, it's wacky engineers making up wacky names again. FOOF is the hexadecimal representation of the first two bytes of an illegal instruction sequence that made Pentium CPUs lock up, thus the name. No, it wasn't hypocritical for Linus to promote the wonders of open source code while collecting a salary from a company that was so closed it wouldn't even tell people what it was doing, The fact is, he respected, and still does, the low-power chip Transmetal was developing, and saw it as the most interesting technology project out there, and the one with the broadest possible implications. And, for the record, Linus was part of an effort to get the company to release at least some of its code. Linus felt pressure to hold his ground within the open source community as someone who could be trusted from both a technology standpoint and an ethical standpoint. It was important to him not to take sides among competing Linux companies. No, he wasn't selling out by accepting stock options that Red Hat was kind enough to offer him as thanks. But it did make sense to turn down the entrepreneur in London who was offering him $10 million just to lend his name to his fledgling Linux company as a board member. He couldn't fathom that Linus would turn down such a huge amount for such little heavy lifting. It was like, what part of $10 million don't you understand? It hadn't occurred to Linus that he might face such issues, and Linux's newfound popularity brought with it some tricky times, not just for Linus, but for the entire virtual community. In fact, as open source code gained the world's attention in 1998, one of the big debates dealt with the name itself. Until then, people had referred to the phenomenon of sharing software under such licenses as the GPL by using the words free software, and in general referred to the free software movement. The term has its roots in the Free Software Foundation, which was founded by Richard Stallman in 1985 to promote free software projects such as GNU, the free Unix he launched. Suddenly, evangelizers like Eric Raymond were finding that journalists were confused. Did the word free mean it didn't cost anything? Did it mean free as in no restrictions? Did it mean free as in freedom? It turned out that Brian Behlendorf, who was talking to journalists on behalf of Apache, was encountering similar frustrations. After weeks of private email exchanges in which Linus was not a participant but was merely sent copies, he wasn't interested in the political side. A consensus was reached. People would refer to it as open instead of free. Hence, the free software movement became the open source movement for people who prefer to see it as a movement. However, the Free Software Foundation is still called the Free Software Foundation, and Richard Stallman is still the psychological mastermind behind it. As Linux came to be viewed as a real threat to Microsoft, and at the time of Microsoft's antitrust woes, it sure needed at least the appearance of a real threat, the press jumped on every development as if it were covering World War III. Somebody leaked the Halloween document, an internal Microsoft memo indicating that the company was concerned about Linux. Soon, Steve Ballmer was quoted as saying, "Sure, I'm worried." The fact was, even if Microsoft stood to benefit by playing up the competition its Windows NT was getting from Linux, the reality was that the competition would only get much more intense. Linus didn't have to stand on a soapbox and say horrible things about Microsoft. What would be the point? Events just played themselves out, and they played themselves out in favor of Linux. Journalists loved it all. The soft-spoken, like a fox, David, versus the monopolistic, mean-spirited Goliath. Linus actually enjoyed talking about it all to reporters. He likes to call journalists scum, but he found most of his interviews to be fun. The reporters typically were interested in the Linux story. Who wouldn't root for the underdog? Linus controls the Linux kernel, the foundation of it all, because so far, everybody connected with Linux trusts him more than they trust anyone else. His method for managing the project with hundreds of thousands of developers is the same as it was when he coded away in his bedroom. He doesn't proactively delegate as much as wait for people to come forward and volunteer to take over things. It started when he divested himself of responsibilities he found less interesting, like the user-level code. People step forward and offer to take over the subsystems. Everything filters up to Linus through the maintainers of those subsystems. He approves or disapproves of their work, but mostly he lets things happen naturally. If two people are maintaining similar kinds of things, he accepts both of them to see which gets used. Sometimes they both get used, but wind up taking different paths. Once, there was intense competition between two people who insisted on sending patches that fought each other's patches. Linus refused to accept patches from either until one of the developers lost interest. That's how King Solomon would have handled things if he ran a preschool. Linus tries to manage by not making decisions and letting things occur naturally. That's when you get the best results. His approach made headlines. But the irony here is that while his Linux management style, such as it is, was earning high marks in the press, he was an undeniable failure during his brief stint as a manager at Transmeta. At one point, it was decided that he should manage a team of developers. He flopped. As anyone who has ventured into Linus's junk heap of an office knows, he's totally disorganized. He had trouble managing the weekly progress meetings, the performance reviews, the action items. After 3 months, it became obvious that his management style wasn't doing anything to help Transmeta, despite the praise he was getting from journalists for the way he was running Linux. Meanwhile, the press kept pounding away at another issue, fragmentation. Those who have followed the rocky, unhappy history of Unix know about the endless bickering between Unix vendors. The question came up all the time in 1998. Would history repeat itself in the world of Linux? Linus's answer was always that while there undoubtedly is bickering among Linux vendors, it can't lead to the fragmentation that has kept Unix a perennial almost bin. The problem with Unix is that competing vendors wasted years implementing similar features simply because they didn't have access to the same source base. Developing the same features independently not only cost Unix years, but it also led to bloody infighting. Sure, Linus would tell the press, Linux vendors don't host regularly scheduled love-ins, but there is and will continue to be less fragmentation inside the Linux community than in the Unix community, because even Linux vendors who are not friendly can see the same source base and can reuse each other's work. The source code is a repository from which anyone can draw. The more journalists started grasping such concepts, the more Linus liked meeting them. Unlike the journalists he remembers from his youth in Helsinki, most of them in the United States in the 1990s were sober. He particularly enjoyed the opportunity to debate with them. But speaking was another matter entirely. Linus is not what you'd call a natural performer. Remember, he's the fellow who barely left his bedroom throughout his childhood. He never was very good at even writing speeches, so he always waited until the night before an event to prepare. Somehow, that didn't seem to matter. Typically, he would step out to the podium and people would rise to their feet and applaud even before he opened his mouth. That's an embarrassing situation. Anything you say sounds wrong. Even his standard, "Thanks, now please sit down." But not all the calls were from journalists or conference organizers. One night, Linus was sitting at home with Tuva. They were reading to the girls. The phone rang. He answered, "Torvalds." "Is this the Linux guy?" "Yes." 2 seconds of silence. Click. Another night, a fellow from Las Vegas phoned him at home, trying to get him to sign on with some Linux t-shirt business. The obvious solution would have been to get an unlisted phone number. He didn't bother to do that when they first moved to California because it was more expensive than having a listed number. He since learned the price you pay for being so frugal and is now unlisted. Once, before he got delisted, I misplaced his home phone number and phone directory assistance. I asked for his number, and the operator who provided it said with great astonishment, "He's listed with all his millions?" But no, there weren't millions. Millions of Linux users, sure. Not millions of dollars for Linus. And that was perfectly fine. Most days, Linus will tell you, he wakes up thinking he's the luckiest bastard alive. He doesn't remember if Wednesday, August 11th, 1999, was one of those days, but it should have been. It was the second day of the Linux World Convention and Trade Show, which had been taking place at the San Jose Convention Center. Dirk Holmdel, who is CEO of SUSE and traveled from Germany for the trade show, had spent the night on the guest bed in the Torvalds family room. Linus has known him for years. He's one of the old ex-Free86 people and is on the graphics side of Linux. He's also Daniela's godfather. Linus woke up, made cappuccino for Tuva and Dirk, read everything in the San Jose Mercury News except the sports pages and the classified ads, like he always does, and then they piled into the Toyota RAV4 for the 10-mile trip to downtown San Jose. Linus remembers shaking a lot of hands. This was the day that Red Hat would be going public. The company had years earlier given him stock options and had only recently sent him some paperwork that he never bothered to look at. It sat somewhere in a stack of papers near his computer. He remembers he really wanted Red Hat to do well. It wasn't so much a matter of being excited about the options. He didn't quite realize what they meant. He was extremely jazzed for another reason. In many respects, the IPO success would be a validation of Linux. So he was a bit nervous that morning, but he wasn't the only one. The market had been doing poorly for weeks, and people wondered whether or not Red Hat would even pull off its IPO. The liquidity event did, in fact, happen. Word came on the conference floor that Red Hat's initial public offering came in at $15 or $18, and it ended the first day of trading at $35. Nothing record-breaking, but it was okay. Linus drove home with Tuva and Dirk in the car, first feeling relieved, then, when he thought about the money, growing excited. Only when they were stuck in northbound traffic on Highway 101 did it strike him that in one day he had gone from basically zero to $500,000. His heart started beating faster. It was elation, tempered with disbelief. Linus was clueless about stock and decided he needed to find out what to do next. So he phoned Larry Augustin, VA Linux's CEO. Linus told him he was the only person he knew who had a clue about how stock works. His exact words, "Do you have like a stockbroker or somebody that you trust because I don't want to go on eBay?" Red Hat had given him options, not an outright grant of stock. He didn't know what to do about exercising them. He knew there might be a lockup period, but he didn't know if it applied to him, and he hadn't thought about the tax consequences. Larry, who is good at this sort of thing and who knows a lot of people, got Linus in touch with a guy at Lehman Brothers, who shouldn't have been handling Linus at all because he wasn't a big customer. The guy promised to find out what Linus should do. Meanwhile, 2 days after the IPO, Linus got an email from someone in Red Hat's human resources department, or their lawyer, in which they mentioned something about the stock having split before the IPO. He knew nothing about it, so he tracked down the manila envelope containing all the stock option paperwork he had never bothered to read, and there it was, in plain, for legalese, English. Linus's options had magically doubled. His $500,000 was actually $1 million. Regardless of the image that has caught on in the press of Linus as a selfless geek for the masses, living under a vow of poverty, he was, frankly, delirious. He sat down and read all the Red Hat papers. Yes, he was subject to a 180-day lockup. You can imagine how long 180 days can be when you're a first-time millionaire on paper. Now, Linus had a new sport, or a sport period, keeping track of Red Hat's stock price, which continued escalating during the following 6 months. It went up gradually and jumped a few times and just grew and grew. At one point, Red Hat even split once more. At best, Linus was worth $5 million from the options. Red Hat started relatively low and inched skyward as Wall Street, in the throes of its love affair with anything even remotely related to the Internet, discovered Linux. Linux was the flavor of the month during the cold weather months at the end of 1999. Investment pundits on television and in the general press couldn't get enough of this crazy little operating system that was promising to upend Microsoft. Linus's phone rang constantly. It all reached a stunning climax with the VA Linux IPO on December 9th. That was an endorsement beyond anyone's expectation. It all happened so suddenly. Figures streamed across monitors indicating that VA Linux, on the first day of trading, was selling in the $300 a share range. This was unheard of. Even if you hadn't seen the figures, you would have known it was a record because of the way the investment bankers were hypnotized by CNN and the Bloomberg Financial Channel. For his part, Larry was his usual cool self. He didn't bat an eyelash during the whole thing. Larry had driven up to San Francisco without much of a financial net worth and drove back to Silicon Valley worth something on the order of $1.6 billion. And, as the press continually pointed out, he was still in his 20s. For his part, Linus had been given a stock grant and options for shares in VA Linux. As with Red Hat, he couldn't sell shares for 6 months, but unlike Red Hat, which climbed steadily, VA Linux had nowhere to go but down. After its record-setting opening day, the stock dropped steadily for a year, reaching a low point of $6. Partly, the stock was a victim of the market correction that hurt most technology stocks that April. But also, Linux's stint as flavor of the month had ended with the spring thaw. Because of the VA Linux lockup period, Linus couldn't take advantage of the hypermarket while it lasted. It was psychologically much harder to follow the company than it had been to follow Red Hat, to know that every night when he crawled into bed, he would wake up with a lessened financial net worth. But he still felt like the luckiest bastard alive. Linus drives up to my Sausalito office one evening in January. "This money thing is driving me crazy," he says. "Just the waiting for the lockup period to end. It's like having lots of money, but not having lots of money. It's on my mind constantly. Up until now, we almost never had more than $5,000 in our checking account. Except for some stocks and stuff we have for savings that we can't touch, that was all the money we had to spend. So now I have all this money on paper and, like, how much money? A couple million? How about 20 million? That's what the stock from VA Linux IPO is worth, as long as it doesn't drop. But I don't have access to the money until the lockup period in 6 months. No, now it's 5 months. I don't see the problem here. You have to wait 5 months before buying a big house. I don't mean to be unsympathetic, but..." He says, "Hey, well, it seems at first that it's enough money that we should be able to buy any house we want, but we need a house with 5 bedrooms, and we want enough land around the house so we can hear animals, and I've been playing pool every day at work, so we'll need a room that's big enough to hold a pool table, and we want a separate unit for when Tuva's parents visit, or so we can have my sister's friends come from Finland and stay a few months and help us with the kids. It's funny. We had Patrizia when we moved from Finland to the States. We had Daniela when we moved from our apartment to the duplex. And..." "So you guys are working on having another kid?" "Well, we're letting things happen naturally," he says. "Where I come from, you pronounce that, we're trying to have another kid, dude." "Okay, so we'll need more space, and we've gone to a couple of open houses, and the houses available are unbelievably expensive. I mean, you get $20 million, and it's like, wow, I can afford any house in the world. But we looked at a house for $1.2 million in Woodside that had no land and was really trashy. The best house we saw was for $5 million. But if you have $20 million, you've got to figure that half of that goes to taxes. Then you have $10 million to work with. But the taxes on a house like that could be like $60,000 a year, so you've got to set aside money for that. And I don't know, this is going to be the only time in my life when I'll get so much money, and I don't want to overextend myself and not be able to afford to live in the house, and we don't want to have a mortgage hanging over our heads." "I'm not feeling sorry for you," I said. "First of all, you'll probably do okay if Transmeta does okay in an IPO." "Yeah, but I'm only a junior engineer," he replied. "So I'm not getting that much stock, and my salary isn't that high." "Linus, you could go to any venture capitalist in this town and get anything you wanted." "I guess you're right," he said. Here are Linus's golden rules. Number one is, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. If you follow that rule, you'll always know how to behave in any situation. Number two is, be proud of what you do. Number three, and have fun doing it. Of course, it's not always easy to be proud and have fun. A month before the VA Linux IPO, Linus accomplished neither when he delivered a keynote speech at the 1999 COMDEX show in Las Vegas. COMDEX, as most everyone knows, is the biggest, baddest trade show known to humanity. For most of a week, the sleepy town of Las Vegas, Nevada, becomes a magnet for every conceivable high-tech product that could possibly be peddled, and the masses of people who would buy and sell them. It's the only time of the year when you can roll down the window of a Las Vegas cab, lean out, and ask a random hooker strutting past, "What time is the keynote?" and she'll know the answer. It was a big deal that the trade show organizers asked the benevolent dictator of Planet Linux to give a COMDEX keynote speech. It was the computer industry's way of acknowledging that Linux was a force with which to be reckoned. Bill Gates delivered the keynote on Sunday, the first night of the show. He had attracted a standing room crowd in the Venetian Hotel Ballroom, which is about the size of 7 average IKEA stores. Conference goers who were eager to hear what he had to say about the antitrust trial, which was happening at the time, or who just wanted to be able to tell their grandchildren they had seen the world's richest man in the flesh, lined up hours beforehand in a snake pattern in the hotel conference center's massive basement level. Gates' speech began with a lawyer joke, then included well-choreographed demonstrations of Microsoft web technology and highly polished video segments. One of them, with Gates dressed like and imitating Austin Powers, that sent the audience into fits of laughter. Linus wasn't there. He was helping Tuva shop for a bathing suit. But the following night, he delivered his speech in the same room. It's not that he wasn't prepared. Ordinarily, Linus writes his speech the day before, but this time he actually got a head start. It was a Monday night speech, and on Saturday he had written it and set up the computer to project its slides. Everything looked really good. He had even put his speech on 3 different floppies, just to protect himself in case one of them might turn out bad. The one thing Linus hates more than speaking is speaking when something goes wrong. He even put his speech on the internet, just in case all the floppies were bad. There was a COMDEX-inspired traffic jam on the Strip, so they arrived at the Venetian Hotel only a half hour before Linus was due to begin. He was with Tuva and the girls and some folks from the show. When they finally got into the building, they had problems getting access to the backstage area because one of the organizers had misplaced the security badges. I mean, everything went wrong. So finally they got inside. Linus would have been nervous if he were about to speak before 40 people, let alone the biggest audience of his life. Then it happened. He discovered that the computer itself, which had been so painstakingly set up 2 days earlier, was nowhere to be found. It was insane. Someone mentioned that people had started lining up for the speech downstairs more than 4 hours in advance, and that the waiting area was packed to capacity. Meanwhile, they were running around like hens without heads, searching backstage for the machine. It was a normal desktop system with StarOffice, one of the Linux office suites installed. And he was supposed to just put in his floppy and go. Everything had been set up so that there wouldn't even be any cables to attach. But the computer had vanished. Apparently, the machine had somehow gotten mislabeled or something. So it was shipped back. Happily, Linus had his laptop with him, and he had the actual slide file of his speech on the laptop, and he did have StarOffice installed. But because this was a laptop, he didn't have all the right fonts. That meant that the last line on all his slides was missing. When Linus realized this, he thought, "Who cares? I'm going to get through this alive." Then they had to hook up all the cables. I mean, literally, they started letting people in before everything was set up. Linus was up there, still trying to get it to work, as a flood of humanity washed into the humongous auditorium, filling every available seat and then filling the standing area along the sides. Luckily, they gave him the standing ovation before he opened his mouth. He started out with some lame reference to the lawyer joke that Bill Gates used to open his speech. He gave a one-sentence hint about what then-secretive Transmeta was developing. It had been wildly rumored in the press that Linus would use the COMDEX speech as an occasion to finally announce Transmeta's chip, but they were just not ready. The main part of his speech simply involved ticking off the benefits of open source computing. He wasn't in a mood to crack as many jokes as he ordinarily does. At one point, Daniela, who was sitting with Tuva and Patrizia in the first row, began a crying spell that was probably audible throughout Las Vegas's casinos and strip clubs. That was not a speech that will go down in history among the great orations. Later, someone tried to cheer Linus up by informing him that Bill Gates, too, had been visibly nervous on the same stage the night before. However, his onstage apparatus had worked without a hitch. The trouble was, he had the U.S. Department of Justice breathing down his neck. I guess Linus came out ahead. It seemed like a strategy out of Journalism 101. Find the person who had been waiting the longest to hear Linus's keynote and hang out with him, undoubtedly him, in line. What better way to gather insight into the dweeby hordes who follow Linus like he's some sort of vendorware-clad god? At 5 p.m., I'm on an escalator descending into Geek Woodstock. At the head of the vast, snaking line is an intense computer science student from Walla Walla College who eagerly agrees to let me join him. He has been waiting, so far, 2.5 hours to see Linus, and he will be waiting another 2.5 hours before being led into the auditorium. His classmates, who are behind him in line, arrived in the queue maybe 1/2 hour after he did. They drove down from Washington State with one of their professors and are sleeping in the gymnasium of a local high school. They all seem to have started their own web design business. They appear to have conveniently divided up the universe of grown-ups into two groups, hackers and suits, and are constantly pointing out members of the latter category in the growing line, saying things like, "Man, look at all the suits here." The way their Delta Tau Chi counterparts might survey a beach during spring break and observe, "Man, look at all the foxes here." But like their Delta Tau Chi counterparts, they are doing all the usual horseplay, slapping each other high fives, trading insults, although the insults all relate to motherboards or gigabytes. And then they talk about Linus. His name comes across capitalized, as in, Linus wouldn't work at a company that wasn't going to be open source. He just wouldn't. They have been slavish scrutinizers of Slashdot and other websites where rumors of Transmeta's hushed goings-on circulate like the lurid details of a Hollywood starlet's love life. This mania and the speculation-slash-fascination isn't happening only among the ardent groupies who arrived here first. I visit the men's room and take my place at the only empty urinal, interrupting a conversation in progress. "This speech is going to be way boring compared to Gates' keynote," says the fellow to my left. "What do you expect?" replies the other guy. "Linus is a hacker, not a suit. I mean, give him a break." When we finally get into the auditorium, somehow we are not up front but toward the back of the middle. My line mate from Walla Walla forgets for a moment about the excitement of seeing his hero live and goes into a rage about not being in the first row, where he deserves to be. Soon he is pointing out the suits in the audience. Even though we're maybe 75 yards from the front, it's possible to catch a glimpse of Linus on the darkened stage, seated at a computer. He quickly types into the computer while being surrounded by a few officials. What could be happening up there? Some sort of last-minute software demonstration? Eventually, Linus and the others leave the stage. Somehow, Linux International Executive Director Mad Dog, John Hull, is introduced. My companion from Walla Walla gets visibly excited. "Check out the beard," he says. Then Mad Dog announces how pleased he is to introduce a man who is like a son to him. Linus reemerges and gets a big, hairy hug from Mad Dog. Even from back in the cheap seats, I could tell he was nervous. "I wanted to start with a lawyer joke, but that was taken," he says, a reference to antitrust suit-plagued Bill Gates' well-received opening the previous night. Anybody heard any good lawyer jokes? He proceeds to give a one-sentence hint at Transmeta's secretive operation. Then, the rest of his speech consists of rattling off the sentences that are flashed on slides high above his head. Statements about the growing importance of open source. Nothing surprising, nothing new. It is delivered in a tired but cheerful monotone. At one point, one of his daughters cries. In mid-sentence, he says, "That's my kid." You could look up at the monitor and see the stage lighting reflecting off the beads of sweat on his forehead. Afterward, audience members line up for questions. He quickly declines to say which of the Linux word processing software he prefers. When someone asks him how many stuffed penguins he has at home, he answers, "Quite a few." An audience member asks how he likes living in California, to which he responds by rhapsodizing about the weather. "It's November, and I'm still wearing shorts," he says. "In Helsinki, I'd have lost my crown jewels by now." A fan walks up to the microphone for audience questions and announces simply, "Linus, you're my hero," to which Linus responds, as if he has heard the same statement a million times and answered it a million times, "Thanks." After the questions are over, hundreds of people flood into the area below the podium, where Linus has now moved and is shaking as many hands as he possibly can. Let me read you something written by Scott Baranato in an article for the magazine PC Week. Quote, "It appears Linus Torvalds has a handler, which must mean this whole Linux thing is mainstream. So forget about the revolution and get back to work on your Windows desktops." Once was a time when reporters could call the inventor of the Linux operating system at his office and receive a familiar declarative Torvalds from the man himself on the other end. He was patient. Sometimes he told you when you asked useless neophyte programmer questions, but he answered the phone. Today, when you call Transmeta and punch in his extension, a pleasant female voice greets you. "Thank you for calling Linus Torvalds. This voicemail does not accept messages. To contact him, please send a fax to..." What? And it starts to sink in. He's not getting back to you. He's had enough. He's a celebrity, and getting a quick interview with him now will be like getting a quick interview with that other big computer industry celebrity. The woman rattles off a fax number, and you're already thinking of hitting the old £0 combo for a receptionist. Our receptionists do not take messages for him, nor do they keep his calendar. Duh. She's pleasant, the worst. But they will gladly get your fax to him. Uh-oh. And Bill will gladly break up Microsoft to appease David Boies. Okay, so the Linux revolution isn't over. But like any revolution, the ragtag riffraff is being superseded by mainstream sympathizers. Suburban new wave supplanted urban punk rock. Wealthy landowners in the colonies rose up after the poor taxed man. The wealthy landowners, by the way, later tried to foist on frontiersmen a whiskey tax not so different from the tea tax imposed on them a few years earlier. In fact, it's probably high time Linus stepped back. It was inevitable, really, given the number of press calls and the maddening range of topics he was fielding. Take his press Q&A at the Linux World Expo in San Jose a few months ago. Torvalds, who agreed to the session because he simply didn't have time to field the innumerable individual requests, first had to rattle off what were becoming familiar answers to familiar questions. Can open source work in the business world? Are you trying to rule software the way Bill Gates rules software? What do you think of Microsoft? What is open source? What is Linux? Why a penguin? Torvalds, by this point, was clearly entering the canned realm of sports figures with his answers. Think Tim Robbins in Bull Durham. "I just need to go out there and give 110% to try and help the team." And beyond the redundant, the questions from journalists outside the tech world veered wildly. At one point during his press conference, the Finnish phenom was asked how he was going to capture the small and medium business market. Typically Torvaldian retort, "I personally haven't tried to capture anyone." Two questions later, an eager, "I've got a unique angle to this open source mess" reporter asks Torvalds what he thought of corporations patenting agricultural genomes. Typically quotable Torvaldian response, "I'm of two minds when it comes to patents. There are good bad ones and really bad ones." Programmers, heed this. If someone starts asking you about agricultural genomes, it's likely time to get a handler. Maybe it's a good thing that Linus doesn't answer his phone anymore. Still, we'll miss the candor and self-deprecation of Torvalds, which came across so genuinely to reporters accustomed to burning their throats on the dry, pressurized airplane air marketing being blown by most companies. And we hope, if faxes do in fact reach his desk, and he does in fact respond to questions, he will keep the Torvaldian tone. Because if the faux-pleasant PR voices take over, this Linux thing won't be nearly so much fun. Anyone reading the above column would assume the mounting pressures of Linus's role as chief nerd had turned him into an asshole. But that's wrong. Linus will tell you he was always an asshole. He thinks voicemail is evil, for example. He thinks it is the perfect example of a bad technology, that it is the worst technology that exists, and he hates it with a passion. So at Transmeta, they started out with a per-user voicemail system that allowed each employee to store 20 minutes worth of messages. After that, callers got the message saying the mailbox was full. Please contact the receptionist. Linus's was always full. It was the journalists who caused the backlash. They would badger the Transmeta receptionists because his voicemail box was full. After the first 100 times, the receptionists started getting irritated. They knew he wasn't interested, and they didn't want to be the ones telling people to get lost. So Linus started deleting messages without listening to them, just so the front desk people wouldn't get annoyed. Most of the time, he would never listen to his messages anyway. For one thing, people usually mumble their phone numbers into the recording, and he would have to listen 15 times just to figure out what they said. Also, he refuses to call people back if he has no reason to call them back. People would get a warm and fuzzy feeling that they had left a message, until they realized he wouldn't return their call. That's when they would call the receptionist. The receptionist wouldn't know what to say, so Linus would tell him or her to tell the caller to fax him. Faxes are as easy to ignore as voicemail, although at least with a fax you could make out the number, should you want to. Linus never wanted to. At first, the receptionist politely told callers to please send Linus a fax. Eventually, people caught on to the fact that he didn't read the fax, and they would call back a week later and complain that they had already faxed him. So the receptionist again got caught in the middle. It wasn't her job to handle his calls. Yes, Mr. Baronato's generous description of Linus in the good old days before Linux took off notwithstanding, he truly always has been an asshole. This isn't anything new. The fax solution didn't last that long. In the end, they set up a special phone messaging account for Linus that didn't have voicemail. Transmeta finally hired a PR person who volunteered to handle Linus's requests. They're trained to do this. They still tell him he should always call journalists back because, even if he doesn't want to talk to them, reporters get a warm and fuzzy feeling that he returns their call. His reaction to that is, he doesn't care about their warm and fuzzies. He does answer his own phone to callers who happen to call while he's sitting at his desk, but that shouldn't be interpreted as an attempt to appear accessible. And it certainly isn't a political statement. The point about open source has never been that Linus is more accessible than anybody else. It's never been that he's more open to other people's suggestions. That's never been the issue. The issue is that even if he's the blackest demon from hell, even if he's outright evil, people can choose to ignore him because they can just do the stuff themselves. It's not about Linus being open. It's about them having the power to ignore him. That's important. There's no official version of Linux. There's Linus's version, and there's everybody else's version. The fact is, most people trust his version and rely on it as the de facto official version because they've seen him work for 9 years on it. He was the original guy, and people generally agree that he's been doing a good job. But even if he shaved his head to display a 666 and said, "Bow before me, because if you don't, I will smite thee," they would just laugh in his face and say, "Okay, we'll just take this little kernel and do what we think is right." People trust Linus, but the only reason they do is that, so far, he's been trustworthy. That doesn't mean he's willing to listen to voicemail, or to anyone who happens to reach him on the phone. He's never felt that people should see him as this good guy who likes to respond to anyone who calls or sends him email. And while we're on the subject, it's strange for Linus to have these stories making him out to be this self-effacing monk or saint who just doesn't care about money at all. He has tried over the years to dispel that myth, but his efforts never make it into print. He doesn't want to be the person the press wants him to be. Crawling out of his bed and into the spotlight, Linus quickly had to learn the sort of tricks of living that other people probably picked up en route to kindergarten. For example, he never could have anticipated how ridiculously seriously people would take him or his every move. Here are two situations, both of them variations on a theme. Back at the university, Linus had a root account on his machine. Every account has a name associated with it. The name is used for informational purposes. So he named his root account on his machine Linus God Torvalds. He was God of that machine, which sat in his office at the university. Is that such a big deal? Now, when somebody fingers a machine under Linux or Unix, they are checking to see who's logged onto that machine. Due to the advent of firewalls, the act of fingering doesn't take place much anymore. But years ago, people would finger another's machine to see if the user had logged on or had read his email. It was also a way of checking out someone's plan, personal information the person had posted on their machine, sort of a predecessor to web pages. Linus's plan always included the latest kernel version. So one way for people to figure out the version of the day was to finger his machine. Some people had even automated the process. They would finger him once an hour as a way of keeping up on version changes. Regardless, whenever someone fingered him, they would see that his root account was named Linus God Torvalds. This wasn't a problem early on. Then he started getting emails from people who told him that was blasphemy. So he eventually changed it. These are people who take themselves too seriously, and that drives Linus crazy. Then, of course, there was the incident in North Carolina. That was bad. A recently published book about Red Hat made it sound like an international incident of potentially catastrophic proportions. It wasn't really much. Linus had been invited to speak at a meeting of Linux users hosted by Red Hat, which is based in Durham. The auditorium was packed. The moment he walked out onto the stage, everybody rose to their feet and started cheering. The first words out of his mouth were the first thing that came to mind. "I am your God." It was meant to be a joke, for crying out loud. It wasn't, "I really am convinced that I am your God and you should never forget it." It was, okay, I know I'm your God. Now please just sit down and hold your appreciation until after you actually hear what I have to say, although I genuinely do appreciate your preemptive appreciation." After his four-word greeting, everyone was silent for a moment. Hours later, those four words had become the topic of newsgroup postings. Linus admits it. It was tasteless, but unintentionally tasteless. Actually, it was probably his way of dealing with the embarrassment of having people stand up and applaud just because he stepped out to the speaker's podium. People take Linus too seriously. They take a lot of things too seriously. And one lesson he's learned from his years as Linux's hood ornament is that there's something worse. Some folks can't be content to just take things too seriously on their own. They're not happy unless they convince others to go along with their obsession. This has become one of his major pet peeves in life. Like the zealots who believe that every innovation should be licensed under the GPL. Richard Stallman wants to make everything open source. To him, it's a political struggle, and he wants to use the GPL as a way to drive open source. He sees no other alternative. The truth is, Linus didn't open source Linux for such lofty reasons. He wanted feedback. And it's how things were done in the early days of computers, when most of the work was done at universities or defense establishments, and they ended up being very open. You gave your source away to another university when people asked for it. What Richard did, after getting cut off from the projects he loved, was to be the first person to consciously open source. Yes, there are enormous benefits to be gained by opening up one's technology and making it available under the same terms as Linux and a host of other innovations. To get a glimpse of those benefits, all you have to do is just look at the comparatively low standards of quality of any closed software project. The GPL and open source model allow for the creation of the best technology. It's that simple. It also prevents the hoarding of technology and ensures that anyone with an interest in a project or technology won't be excluded from its development. The GPL is wonderful in its gift of letting anyone play. Just think about what a major advance for humanity that is. But does that mean that every innovation should be GPL'd? No way. It should be up to the individual innovator to decide for herself or himself whether to GPL the project or to use a more conventional approach to copyright. Linus admires Richard from afar for a bunch of reasons. He tends to respect people, like Richard, who have very strong moral opinions, but he wonders why they can't keep those opinions to themselves. The thing he dislikes the most is when people tell him what he should or should not do. Over the course of the development of Linux, pundits such as Eric Raymond have suggested that the operating system's success and the longevity of open source development have partly hinged on Linus's pragmatic approach and his ability to keep from taking sides in disputes. While Eric is arguably the best articulator of the open source phenomenon, Linus believes he's a bit off the mark on his perception. It's not that Linus keeps from taking sides, it's just that he so strongly resents anyone who tries to impose his or her morals on others. You can replace the word morals with religion, computing preferences, whatever. Just as imposing morals is wrong, the next step, institutionalizing morals, is doubly wrong. Linus is a big believer in individual choice, which means that he thinks he should make his own decisions when it comes to moral issues. Linus wants to decide for himself. He's very much against unnecessary rules imposed by society. He's a big believer that you should be able to do whatever you want in the privacy of your own home, as long as you don't hurt anybody else. Any law saying otherwise is a very, very broken law. And there are laws that say otherwise. Linus finds some scary rules, especially some that are imposed on schools and children. Imagine even thinking of imposing rules about teaching evolution, and taking that into the wrong direction. That he finds scary. This is social conscience rearing its ugly head in places it really has nothing at all to do with. At the same time, his personal belief is that what is more important than him and his individual moral decisions is not even the human race, but evolution. To that extent, he wants his individual choices to take social issues into account. But he thinks that's probably built into evolution, that we do take social things into account. Otherwise, we'd have been gone long ago. The only other thing worth ranting about? People who are too preachy. There's just no reason for folks to evangelize, and to be so self-righteous about it. But it's an easy trap when people start taking you far too seriously. You enter this house not as a journalist, but as a friend. We are allowing no journalists in this house. I had never seen Tuva so ebullient. She greeted me at the door of the new house on the day she and Linus received the key. It's one of those monster homes. The media room, which now houses Linus's pool table, probably doesn't share a zip code with a super bonus room, where Patricia and Daniela sleep, although it could handle an entire preschool. From the front door, there's a wide, long-angled hallway leading way back to the family room. If they remove the fancy Italian tiles, it will be a great place for the girls to practice skateboarding someday. Linus's office on the first floor has a mirrored sliding glass door. 5 bathrooms. Maybe they found more of them by now. It's all in a gated community, far from the heart of Silicon Valley. Did you ever think our house would be this big? Tuva asks me. Tuva needed to be on hand at the opening of the IKEA store in Emeryville to buy armoires for the new house, so I suggested Linus bring the kids over to a house I was renting in Stinson Beach. As soon as they arrived, I urged Linus to try out the kayak in the lagoon. He paddled around by himself, then with each of the girls, and climbed back onto the dock with wet pants. I wanted Linus to give me his thoughts on a chapter of our book entitled "Will Success Spoil Me?" and took the girls outside to the beach so he could read it undisturbed. Patricia and Daniela spent maybe a half hour hunting for starfish and tiptoeing into the water, after which one of them announced, "Kissin Comer," which translates to, "I've got a potty." We returned to the house to find Linus sitting at the computer, in his underwear, a bag of pretzels at his side, intently typing away. It took him maybe 15 seconds to realize we had arrived. He looked up from the monitor. His first words were, "Boy, your Macintosh sucks." Then, "Oh, and I put my pants in your dryer." It's easy to fight windmills if you don't realize how hard it is. 5 years ago, when people asked Linus if he thought Linux would be able to take over the desktop and make a dent in Microsoft, they always had a doubtful edge to their voice. He invariably told them that he thought it would. They would look skeptical. The fact is, they probably knew more than he did about the reality. He didn't really understand all the steps it would take to get there, not only what it takes to tackle the technical problems of developing a robust and portable operating system, but what it takes to make that operating system a commercial, as well as technical, success. He would have been discouraged if he had known in advance just how much infrastructure would need to be in place to make Linux as successful as it has been. It's not only that you have to be good. You have to be good, sure, but everything has to turn out the right way, too. Any sane person would have gazed up at the rugged mountain face that needed to be scaled and would have been absolutely daunted. Just think about the technical problems of supporting PCs, which are about the most varied hardware out there. You have to support people who have bugs that you can't reproduce on applications that you don't even care about. But you care about Linux, so you care about helping to fix them. Even to think about penetrating the commercial market, you have to have a respectable level of user support. From early on with Linux, you could have real support by doing it internally within a company. But to make it in a big way, you have to have a lot of people and a lot of infrastructure. It's not enough to have a 1-900 number or a 1-800 number for the first 30 days. To some extent, support is no longer much of an issue because it can be bought at any number of places. LinuxCare, Red Hat, IBM, Silicon Graphics, Compaq, Dell. But it clearly was something that had to be in place. For the longest time, Linus didn't even realize that. It has been a major challenge for years. Unlike business people with solid technical backgrounds or journalists with a commercial bent, he was a narrowly focused software developer who was naive about what would be required. Linus believes the technical problems alone would have kept him from embarking on this journey. If he had known how much work it would take, and that he would still be doing it 10 years later, and that it would be almost a full-time job those entire 10 years, he never would have started. And the abuse! He doesn't get that much abuse these days, but it still happens. People who don't like open source, or people who are just upset about bugs, will send him email, cursing him over their frustrations. Compared to the amount of positive mail he gets, it's minuscule, but it still happens. Yes, he says, if he had realized how much work and how hard, how difficult a lot of things would have been, he probably would not have done it. If he had had enough knowledge to understand the problems in advance, he probably never would have taken Linux far beyond its initial release. If he had known how much detail you have to get right, and how much people expect of an operating system, he would have been able to envision horror scenarios of things he couldn't handle. But he also wasn't able to predict the upside, like how much support he would get, and how many people would be working together on this. So now, after telling me this, he has changed his mind. If he had actually known the upside, he probably would have done it. The intellectual property debate is so hot these days that Linus can't wander into a restroom without running across graffiti supporting one side or the other. Some people think that patents and other forms of intellectual property law are the bane of the free universe, and that these laws are not just misguided, but actually evil and should be struck down as soon as possible. Others are convinced that pretty much the whole world economy is driven by intellectual property. And those people want to do anything to strengthen the legal status of IP rights. As a result, the graffiti on the issue gets quite graphic at times. Of course, most of the graffiti is on the virtual restrooms on the internet. There will be huge flame fests over some specific issue associated with intellectual property law, with people arguing everything from First Amendment rights to whether IP law might make open source development impossible sometime in the future. And Linus finds himself certifiably schizophrenic on the issue. It's not that he doesn't have an opinion. He has very strong opinions on the worth of intellectual property, but they end up being on both sides of the argument. This can be very confusing. It means that Linus ends up arguing both sides. And he thinks this is because there really are two sides to intellectual property, and they share nothing but the name. Creativity, whether it be in the form of painting, music, sculpture, writing, or programming, should be sacred. The creator and the thing he or she created have a bond that cannot be severed. It's like the bond between a mother and child, or between bad Chinese food and MSG. But at the same time, it's something that everybody in the whole world should be able to be part of, because it is humanity. And then, in the other corner, weighing in at approximately 7 gazillion billion US dollars a year, intellectual property is huge business. Human creativity got a price tag, and it turned out to be quite expensive. Creativity is rare, and as a result, it is not just expensive, but also extremely lucrative. Which brings in a totally different class of arguments, and totally different kinds of people. The kind of people who call the end result of human creativity property. Not to mention, of course, lawyers. The property people are winning. After all, their name stuck. So what's the problem? The most well-known example of intellectual property is the notion of copyright. Copyrights are basically the codification of the rights of any creator to do with his or her creation as he or she wants. The owner of the creation can decide on how that creation should be used. Copyrights are also legally very simple to get. You don't have to register your copyright. You are automatically the copyright holder of whatever creative work you do. This is an important distinction from most other intellectual property law, mainly because it actually makes it easy for individuals, not just big corporations, to own copyrights. You can own a copyright simply by virtue of writing, painting, or generally creating something unique. If you want to, you can add a legend like Copyright 2000, your name here. But quite frankly, you don't need to. You own the copyright whether you say so or not. Saying so just makes it easier for other people to track you down if they want to use your work. Of course, just owning a copyright in itself is not very useful, but the fact that you own what you create means that you can control how it is used. You have, for example, the right to sell such a work of art to somebody else, and nobody but the IRS gets to have any say in the matter. But it's about more than just the money, and that's where a lot of people seem to find themselves flummoxed. For example, you can use your power as owner of a copyright to try to do more interesting things than just sell it. You can license it. This is even better than selling it. Instead of selling the work of art, you can sell the license to do certain things to it, and still retain the copyright on it. Basically, you can have your cake and eat it too. This is how the Microsofts of the world get created, endlessly selling the rights to use something, without actually losing anything. No wonder people just love to own this kind of property. Does anybody perhaps start to see a problem here? If you don't see anything strange so far, I have a bridge and a few pieces of waterfront property to sell you. The basic problem with intellectual property is starting to show itself. You, as the owner of intellectual property, can effectively sell it forever without ever losing anything yourself. You don't risk anything, and in fact, you might decide to write your license in a way that basically says that even if the property is flawed, you cannot be held responsible in any way. Sounds preposterous? You'd be surprised. Flaw? No consumer protection. It gets worse. The copyright holder not only has the right to sell his or her property without losing it, but also the right to sue people who sell property that looks like his or hers. Clearly, the copyright owner has rights over that derived work. Clearly, not so fast. Where do you draw the line between inspiration and copying? And what happens when different people come up with similar ideas? Who gets the gravy train of being able to sell his idea over and over again and gets to tell other people to butt out of his business? It's not just consumers who aren't protected. It's also other creative people who are not protected by the notion of intellectual property. What makes the discussion ugly at this point is that a lot of the arguments for stronger intellectual property rights are based on the notion of giving inventors and artists more protection. What people don't seem to ever realize is that giving such powerful rights to some people also ends up taking rights away from others. And maybe not so surprisingly, the proponents of stricter intellectual property laws are the organizations that stand to gain the most. Not the artists and inventors themselves, but the clearinghouses of IP, companies that make a living off other people's creativity. Oh, and lawyers, of course. The end result? Copyright law amendments like the infamous Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, which removes the last vestiges of consumer rights over the use of copyrighted material. Now, if you are getting the notion that Linus thinks copyrights are actually detrimental, you're wrong. He happens to absolutely love copyrights. He just doesn't believe in taking the rights of the authors too far, not to the point of screwing the consumer over. And he says this not just as a consumer, but as a producer of copyrighted material himself. Linus, as a copyright holder, has his rights. But with rights come obligations, or as they say in certain neighborhoods, noblesse oblige. And so Linus believes he has the obligation to use those rights in responsible ways, and not as a weapon against others who lack such rights. As one great American once declared, "Ask not what your copyright can do for you, ask what you can do for your copyright," or something to that effect. And in the end, copyright is, despite even the DMCA, a fairly mild and well-behaved form of intellectual property. The notion of fair use does still exist, and holding a copyright does not give all rights to the work to the copyright holder. The same cannot be said for patents, trademarks, and trade secrets, the heavy drugs of IP. Discussions over software patents in particular have gotten so inflamed in technical circles that it officially counts as one of the subjects you should not discuss in polite company, along with gun control, abortion rights, medical marijuana, and whether Pepsi tastes better than Coca-Cola. And the reason is that patents, in many ways, give control over new inventions similar to that of copyrights, but with few of the redeeming qualities of copyrights. One of the most awkward issues with patents is that, unlike with copyrights, you don't get a patent just for inventing something new. No, you get a patent after you've gone through the painful and prolonged process of filing for it with the patent office. Waiting for the patent office, by the way, is a bit like standing in line at the DMV, but you have to realize that you stand in line with about 12 patent lawyers, and the line is 2 years long. In short, it's not something you do for fun on a Friday evening if the kids fell asleep early. As if to add insult to injury, the patent office doesn't necessarily have the resources to check whether the patent for a new invention of yours is really all that groundbreaking. It's fairly hard to give new inventions their proper checking, which means that, in many cases, obviously bogus patents have been accepted.